Good afternoon, Bay Area. Welcome to the Sights and Sounds Show with me, Janae Darden, where every week we tap into the Bay Area art scene and bring you rich conversations with artists. On today's show, author Soma Mae Shung Frazier talks about her debut novel, Off the Books, which is about a young Oakland woman who works as an underground chauffeur. Then in her new novel, Oakland author Carolina Ixta takes us to Southern California, where a high school student is fighting environmental justice in her community and falling in love with her classmate. Today's show is about young sheroes. That's all coming up. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Sights and Sounds Show with me, Janae Darden, right here on KALW 91.7 FM. In the novel, Off the Books, a young Chinese Oakland woman has a secret underground job. She chauffeurs mysterious people to their destinations, no questions asked. But she has a lot of questions for her new client who needs a ride across the country to transport a large black suitcase. Now, what's in the suitcase is also a mystery. Off the Books is the debut novel by Soma Mae Shung Frazier. It has gotten a lot of good buzz from such outlets as the New York Times and the San Francisco Chronicle. Soma is the former San Francisco Library Laureate, and now she's a creative writing professor at State University of New York at Oswego. We talked about themes of family, grief, and romance in her book. Soma Mae Shung Frazier, welcome.
Well, hello, Janae Darden.
We've been trying for the longest. It's my fault, but we finally made this happen. So I'm so excited that you are here. Congratulations on your book that has done so well, your debut novel.
Thank you so much. I listen to your show, and wherever I am, it transports me right back to the Bay Area. So it's just very surreal to talk about that debut novel with you on air instead of listening to you on air.
Oh, no. Yeah, you always, I know you live on the East Coast, but you know, you always still part of the Bay. So that's why I was like, I gotta have Soma on. So Soma, I've known you for a while now, and we met through the literary community, writers community here in the Bay Area. So when did you know you wanted to be a writer?
Pretty young. I think for me, like, the love of writing stemmed from reading. And my dad, he taught me how to read as a baby with these big old flashcards. And so I was this weirdo nerd kid. So around four, I like completed the Agatha Christie books. I read the Edgar Rice Burroughs Tarzan series.
Well, hold on, at four?
Yes, my dad.
Wow.
He was like, I'm building me a nerd. And he did.
So wait a minute. Wait, hold on, let me backtrack. Because you said he taught you how to read as a baby.
Yes.
So like, how old were you when you could read?
I read my very first word at 8 months, which is crazy because I wasn't really talking. So it's just like visual recognition.
Wow.
And I connect the thing to the sound to the image. And I also, you know, my kid, Adrian, straight out of Kaiser Permanente, Oakland, I was like, all right, here's the flashcards. And so he read no on a no smoking sign around that age. And even I was startled. I was like, what? I see it from the outside and it's crazy to look at.
That is really amazing that you're reading Agatha Christie at 4 years old. That's wild. So you're originally from New Hampshire.
Yes, very rural New Hampshire.
Very rural New Hampshire, an area that you don't really hear much about, at least on this side of the country.
Yeah, and I think that's why I got into writing, because I was like, okay, I can not only read these stories, but make the stories. And that was another way to live inside them instead of in rural New Hampshire. So I was juiced when I figured out that I could just write and go wherever I wanted.
And you've traveled too as well and studied in different places, lived on the East Coast and the West Coast. I mean, also too, I know a thing that comes up in your work is being mixed race. How does that influence you as a writer too as well?
I think that it gives me, you know, I guess the obvious answer would be two perspectives, but maybe each of us only has our one perspective, and it was interesting to grow up seeing the miscommunications between Chinese culture and American culture. Especially my dad's a Texan, so Texan culture is very different from Chinese culture. And that too kind of pointed me toward writing, because I thought, man, if we could just express ourselves a little better to each other, make ourselves a little more understood, then things would go better for us.
Yeah. Yeah. And so dad's white.
Yep.
And then mom's Chinese.
Yep.
Okay. And then mom taught at Dartmouth.
She did. And as you can imagine, in rural New Hampshire, she's this professor walking around with a baby who, you know, I think I came out and she was like, "You are light, bright next to white. What happened to you?" So folks would come up to her and say like, "Oh, whose baby is this?" You know, mistaking her for a carer. So, but yeah, she was a nerd like me.
Yeah, and you hear that a lot, unfortunately, with people, you know, of mixed race, where they'll look at the parent and be like, "Oh," and assume that they're like the nanny or something like that.
Yeah, people have asked me about my own kid, and I'm like, you know, let me explain some biology to you. When two people meet and fall in love, even if two race.
Yeah, it's like science, folks. And so you talk about when two people fall in love. Now let's talk about your book, Off the Books. Because I was so excited for you. I have over the years been reading articles like in reviews of your book. So that's another reason why, too. I'm just so happy that you're here. And then knowing you, you know, I'm happy for you. But I felt a little deceived by some of the things I read, because people were saying like, this is a romance. And as I'm reading it, I'm like, this is more than a romance. And like, it's a mystery. And then it's kind of literary fiction. And there's some serious, you know, some themes in here about, like, you know, different social issues, international issues.
Oh, thank you.
To me, you can't put Off the Books in a box. Like, how would you describe it? Like, what would you categorize it as?
I think that is probably the result of this being my debut novel. And so I was like, let's throw a little of everything in there. I went to write a pretty serious story about an international egregious like issue. And then I remembered the words of an agent I had spoken with a long time ago, not my current literary agent, who said, you know, you got to infuse light into everything so people can read it, because the world is so grim and our news that we read is so grim. Just put some light and love in there. So yeah, it turned into like a road trip romance with a dash of like international politics. I'd classify it as like upmarket, because it has sort of commercial plot elements and literary craft elements.
Yeah. Okay. I can see that. Yeah, because I was like, you can't put it in a box. So when I went in thinking it was one thing, I was like, this is not what I thought it was.
Bait and switched you. You're like, beach read, I'm gonna get the spicy romance, and then no.
Right. I was like, she's gonna make me think. It's so much in there, which is good. And there's humor in there too as well. So it makes you laugh. And then there's some romance. You're like, are they gonna, you know? So all that's going through your head. And then it's like, what's really in this suitcase? Mm-hmm. So let me back up. So the main character, May, is grieving her father's absence and drops out of college. And she has taken on this dangerous underground job. I think it's dangerous.
Yeah.
Like driving sex workers and other mysterious clients to places she doesn't really know where she's going. Kind of a symbol of her life right now, right? Because she's grieving the absence of a father. So describe her person. Oh, and she's from Oakland. Describe May's personality, because I'm thinking her personality, you wouldn't expect somebody like her to do this kind of work.
Yeah. So she, I think, as you said, she sort of like hasn't found herself yet. She's a little lost. She's young and not very knowledgeable about the world beyond Oakland. And when I went to Oakland, I fell in love with it. As you know, it's sort of like, it's temperate all year round. The people are friendly, the pace is livable. And so it's easy to not understand how crazy something on the other side of the world, like the situation, might be there, because we don't hear about it. And here we are in this place with palm trees and sun. So I would say she's young. I guess that's how I would describe her.
So I understand your father worked in U.S. military intelligence. And I was thinking about this character, May, who has a secret career. Did being around your father, who worked in this underground kind of, you know, field, did that help with your imagination when creating this book and this character?
Yes. I mean, I have a lot of friends who have worked in careers that are not public, but my dad, actually the other night, I I woke up in my dark bedroom, wrote a poem on my phone, apparently emailed it to myself, and went right back to sleep. But it's about like growing up with the type of guy who has a very unique career, like Maze. It is on my desk if you want to hear it.
Yeah, if you wish, go for it.
All right. It is literally on my desk because I was so stunned that I did this that I printed it out. I was like, what? Why? Subconscious? It's weird. It's called Target Practice with Dad.
Okay.
Can I write this poem without alcohol, the courage of youth, or getting disowned again? Can I write it now that my father rests in a Ziploc bag, in a Folgers tin, in a Vegas storage unit unfamiliar to me, and my mother has gone and lost the key? Can I write, I was the bottle balanced on a log, the paper bullseye clipped to a branch in the fog, and also the girl who held the gun as its kick knocked me on my ass, as I felt the cold breath of the earth through the grass behind our cinder block home. I was the glass shard we left in the ground, and also the soul of my barefoot that found it there. I was spruce needles jumping in bracing air and their shadows piercing my skin. I was the soft thing he stabbed and the blade that went in, the forgetting and the remembering.
Mm.
Yeah, so he was, you know, we had a code word in case someone took me, so that if they called him on the phone and said, you know, we have your daughter, he could verify that they had me.
Mm-hmm.
So to me, May having this job that's illicit and off the books, was, I didn't even think about it as like an odd thing, just because I grew up with in such odd circumstances.
Yeah. Wow. And I see some connections to your dad. And I'm thinking about May's dad in the book and when she has memories of him. And so I definitely see some connections. You both have May in your name. And I know you told me so, but like, you're like, there's no similarities, but the dads are kind of similar. I'm getting a similar vibe from the dads.
So this is the, you know, write what you know thing. So I picked, those aspects, the formal aspects of my dad, like what he does. My dad was also, you know, knew 18 dialects of different languages, but he was not a nice man. And May's dad is a nice man.
Okay. Yeah. But there's still some distance, right?
Yes.
I was picking that up in your poem. Like there's still some distance in the relationship. If you're just tuning in, I'm speaking with author Soma May Shung Frazier. We're talking about her debut novel, Off the Books, and it's about a young woman from Oakland who goes on a road trip with a very handsome young man. And he has a big suitcase, and she doesn't know what's in the suitcase. And she has this underground job where she transports people who are sex workers and other mysterious folks to places, and she doesn't know anything about it. So it's a mystery, it's a romance, it's all kind of stuff. Okay, so family is important in this book. May has a strained relationship with her mother and her grandfather. Her grandfather is not the typical Chinese grandfather that we see in stories. He is very much an Oakland Chinese grandpa that grew up around some black folks, okay? Because he got a black girlfriend. He plays video games. He smokes a weed.
He does.
And he actually encouraged May to take on this crazy job.
Yes. Yeah.
Tell us about Grandpa.
Well, he might say that he smokes for his glaucoma, but no one would believe him.
That's what they all say from his generation.
Mm-hmm, right? His character is really based on the playful spirit of my own waipo, which means maternal grandma in Chinese.
Mm-hmm.
She was this trickster who lived to 110 years old.
My goodness. Wow.
Yeah, she was a... Well, she lived to 109 in American years, but the Chinese count the year in the belly, too. So I was like, I'm going to give grandma that extra year because...
Give her that, yeah.
Yes. And she did not play as many video games as Lao Ye and Off the Books, but she was a poker shark. And I remember, you know, when her doctor said, cut back on chocolates, my auntie hid all the chocolates, these like Linder truffles in the pantry, and thought like, okay, she's off them, until one day she went to eat a chocolate herself, dipped her hand in, and just came up with these collapsed wrappers that were all empty because Waipo had like snuck all the chocolates out the wrappers, rewrapped the wrappers, put them back in there. She did that kind of thing. She also defended her house against a would-be thief, holding him off with my grandpa's gun.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, you can't mess with old folks.
Right? You might get shot. You might get offered a chocolate with nothing in it.
That's right. Or a chocolate-covered bullet. Because especially a certain generation, you have old folks, you know, they grew up in rural areas, and they know how to shoot.
Yeah.
You know? And so, and they're not afraid to do that.
She's so tough. I asked her once, you know, she had 9 children.
Oh, wow.
And I said, how, you know, you're so strong. And she said, no, what's that? That's called, like, what's the word in American, in English? Stupid. I was like, okay, grandma, I see. But yeah, tough, styly, clever.
Yeah, you got to be tough to raise 9 kids. So yeah, wow. Okay. So you got that character from grandma. Grandpa is... If any reason why to read the book is for grandpa. Grandpa is hilarious. And I love, too, that May, she, you know, that's who kind of is her guy. She checks in with him. So in a way, he's not your typical Chinese grandpa that you see in literature and in movies and in films. But he does impart that wisdom that you usually see, you know, from those type of characters. And he is like a guide for her. And another man in her life is Henry. And this is the guy that she's transporting cross country, and he has this black suitcase, and we don't know what's in it, and we're not gonna tell what's in it because I don't want to spoil it for folks. But you know, I guess if you want to take a trip from, you know, Oakland to upstate New York, you want to be in a car with Henry because he's fine.
Uh-huh. You know, I had Henry Golding in mind when I named him.
Henry Golding, if we could all find somebody cute like Henry. But, you know, and it's not just about looks either, right? Like, it's not just about, because he was very mysterious.
Yeah.
Which is attractive.
Yeah. To find out, you know, why if someone is kind of closed mouth is always like, it's always an extra curiosity sprinkled in.
Yeah. And he was a bit snarky.
Mm-hmm.
And May, that's why it's like she's courageous in that she's taking on this job, but she's so like nervous around him. And I'm like, girl, you are transporting people. You know, and I don't mean she's not trafficking people. I mean, like, just taking people that are doing illegal jobs. She's their driver, and she's so scared to even flirt with him.
Yeah, you know, I feel like that is a function of youth. I remember like jumping off trestle bridges into water where who knows how deep it is or what's buried under the surface of the water, and yet, you know, having a social interaction would just make me quake. I was like, oh no.
It would just make you blush. Yep. Yeah, that's what was interesting. I was like, girl, go for it. Y'all in the middle of Indiana.
You know, she actually did go for it. The book was a little spicier before my first editor got her hands on it. And she was like, this can't happen.
Shame on your first editor. You tell your first editor, we like spice. We can have spice and talk about political, international issues.
Yes, we can have it all.
Oh, okay. Well, in the book, there are characters who are refugees, and they're Uyghurs. Is that how we pronounce it?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. Uyghurs from China. They're a group of people. They are Muslim. Mm-hmm. And China has been accused by Western nations, such as the U.S., of committing genocide against these people, having them do forced labor, being put in camps. And the Chinese government has denied these allegations of human rights abuses. And they said that what they're doing is trying to stop Islamic extremist terrorism. And so this is addressed in the book. We have characters from that community of the Uyghurs. Tell us more about this issue and why you wanted to include this in your novel. That is mystery and romance.
Might as well throw some tragedy in. I, you know, as a Chinese American person, I'm so proud of America and so proud of China in so many ways, and so ashamed of America and so ashamed of China in so many ways. And I don't think we hear much about what's going on across the globe. But You know, Dr. Martin Luther King said injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. And China's our, you know, top three American trade partner. And the U.S. government, you know, has declared a genocide going on there. They acknowledge it as a genocide, as you said, but yet it's kind of business as usual. And it's a very complex issue. There are many comparisons that could be made, but imagine conducting business with Nazi Germany, not a good look. And I feel like we have to pay close attention to folks who are vulnerable in other countries, because the world is getting smaller and smaller. And so even if we think of them as far away, they're our neighbors.
How did this all happen? What started this?
It's been going on since the 30s. China's just such a vast nation.
Wow, since the 1930s?
Yes. Yeah. The Uyghur people have, you know, wanted to be autonomous, and China has sought to integrate them and assimilate them for quite a long time. And you just don't hear about you know, China likes to present a unified front, but the people are not a monolith. So things escalated. There was some violence on both sides, but the enormity of the detention of ethnic minorities and the punitive nature of the rules, like, you know, you have the wrong beard, you can be detained. You have, like, you know, Muslim literature, you can be detained is pretty, you know, it had me, like, when I was doing research, I was like, where's my flask?
Yeah, imagine. Yeah, because it's heartbreaking when you hear the allegations. And yeah. I'm reading this BBC article, and it says anti-Hondos are like Chinese people who are not Muslim. So it says, and I have a link on our website. So it says anti-Han and separatist sentiment rose in, is this area called Xinjiang?
Yes. And so that's the autonomous region that they call Xinjiang.
Okay, Xinjiang. Okay, so it says separatist sentiment rose in Xinjiang from the 1990s, sometimes flaring into violence. And then in 2009, about 200 people died in those clashes, which the Chinese blamed on the Uyghurs who wanted their own state. But in recent years, a massive security crackdown has crushed dissent. So this is from the BBC, just to add more to, like, the history of, like, what built up to... Mm-hmm. Yeah, to what's been going on. Yeah.
Yeah. But, you know, now teachers, journalists, folks, you know, housewives are detained. Actually, I spoke with a Radio Free Asia reporter about the book. She interviewed me to broadcast our interview in the Uyghur language in China. And she mentioned that she was on a team of 8 reporters who were Uyghur families still living in China. And all of her coworkers had a family member detained, every single one of them.
Wow.
Yeah. And so the government will even sort of threaten or just disappear people who are related to folks who may be in different countries reporting on the issue. They're very, you know, they want their business to stay private.
Wow. Yeah. So I just encourage people just to read up on what's happening there. So you're working on your next book.
Yes.
And what is it about?
It is, the shortest way to describe it probably is it's an Oakland, California ghost story set in Chinatown. It's about a girl who inherits an old Victorian home from her favorite uncle and has to decide whether to kind of stay in the town, deal with the home's many issues, or take off and follow her own other path.
Okay. Is it a scary ghost story or?
You know, it has a scary moment or two, but I think there's a lot of humor in it. I think after writing off the books, I needed to write something that had lighter moments, and it deals with some serious themes, but I would not describe it as a scary book.
Okay. And when can we expect that book?
February 27.
Okay. Of 2027?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. All right. So we have about a year. So folks can read off the books now, and then if they haven't read it, and then read this next. What's the title? Do you have a title yet?
It's called Eat Bitter Anastasia.
Eat Bitter Anastasia.
Yeah. There's this Chinese saying about eating bitter, and most people, you know, you can take it to mean you got to swallow the bad things and just like deal with them, but they don't know the whole phrase. So the book sort of deals with the whole idea of eat bitter.
Ah, okay. Well, Soma, good luck with finishing up writing your book, your next book, and working on it. And congratulations on Off the Books. And you got to come back next year to talk about your new book.
Heck yeah. I'm hoping to come back in person because I miss the Bay Area so much.
We'll be happy. We'll be welcoming you with open arms and books for you to sign.
I got my pen ready.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
That was author Soma May Shung Frazier. Her novel, Off the Books, is in bookstores now. Coming up, teen romance and environmental activism meet in a novel by Bay Area author Carolina Ixta. Don't turn that dial or click away. We'll be back. You're listening to The Sights and Sounds Show with me, Janae Darden, on KALW 91.7 FM. In her first novel, Shut Up, This Is Serious, writer Carolina Ixta showed readers what it's like living in Oakland's Fruitvale neighborhood through the eyes of two Latina teenagers. And that book resonated with me because that was my community when I was a teenage girl. For her sophomore novel, the award-winning author takes young readers to Southern California's Inland Empire. Few Blue Skies is about a Mexican-American teenage girl who's also a journalist and activist. She's advocating against a company that's been polluting her community, and they want to build a warehouse right next to her high school. The story is inspired by real-life incidents, and I spoke with Carolina about environmental injustice in communities of color, how protesting can affect an activist's personal life, and teen romance in her novel. Carolina Ixta, so good to see you again.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Oh, Carolina, this book.
Yeah, I'm glad you're enjoying it.
I am. So many emotions are coming out of me. So this book takes place in Southern California in the Inland Empire, which are areas in and near Riverside. And in the story, a corporation is building warehouses in and near residential areas. And your characters, they're teenagers and they're fighting, and adults too, and they're fighting against a warehouse being built next to a high school, to their high school. Now, this is a novel, but these are real issues that are really happening. So what led to you writing this story and covering this environmental issue?
Well, the book was inspired by a couple of things, but mainly it was like my upbringing in studying to become a teacher. I took a class called Urban Education with my professor, Mandela Shaw, at UC Santa Cruz. And in the class, she assigned a reading about the water contamination that was prevalent in Oakland Unified School District public schools at the time, and also still is a major problem they're dealing with. And all of my classmates were discussing the article, and they were like, it was kind of a pity party for them, you know, of like, oh, these poor brown and black children in Oakland. And for me, I was like, wow, I went to school at some of those schools. My mom was the principal or the teachers, you know, or a teacher at some of those schools. There are family members that I've had that have gone to these schools. And so I understood at that point that I knew I wanted to write about environmental racism and injustice. And later in my education at Santa Cruz, I took a class called Eco Poetry, and it was literally a class that was just about poetry as it related to nature and the earth. And I didn't want to take it, and I had to take it as a graduation requirement. And I would like drag my feet and complain about going to class, but it ended up really teaching me quite a lot about the environment as this intersection for issues of injustice. And we had these really rigorous and grounding conversations about race and class as it relates to nature. And I really enjoyed it. And I then had to do a final for the class. And because it was a poetry class, an option was to write poetry about a pressing issue in the environment that was happening. And I wrote about the Richmond Chevron oil refinery. Mm-hmm. And I wrote about how those students frequently had to leave school because there were gasoline leaks that were happening in the area. So I had all of this knowledge that was really local, like in Oakland and Richmond, all of these issues that were very prevalent. But in my childhood, I spent quite a lot of time in the Inland Empire. My godmother lived in Riverside, still lives there, has lived there my whole life. And so I was visiting the Inland Empire in my early 20s quite often. And I realized that they were having a very similar issue as what was happening in Richmond, which was that there were these
essentially factories. I wouldn't actually, they're not factories. They're distribution centers where like anything you buy from Target, Amazon, Walmart, Pepsi, it's all kind of held. And imagine like a really, really, really huge storage locker. And when I mean huge, it's like, I think warehouses in some of these cities encompass over 1 billion feet of square footage, right? Like they're huge. Wow. And there's these massive parking lots with semi-trucks, like big rigs that are driving in and out for deliveries and spewing all of this toxic emissions into the air. And compared to the refinery in Richmond, where you see it and you see that this is, you know, very clearly a very industrial factory, these warehouses look really nondescript and very anonymous. They frequently, it was really hard to find the signage of like, who owns this building or what is this building for? Because there were so many of them. They're just big gray blocks. And I learned that the Inland Empire had this really massive problem with air pollution. And I mean, to add insult to injury, in 2022, when I got the idea for this book, there was a warehouse that was proposed to be built directly next to a high school. So those kids would be obviously highly exposed to these very toxic chemicals. And so I just thought how unfair it was for those children, like one, to have to breathe in all of these terrible chemicals, like imagine doing gym class outside and something like that, right? And two, to look at these really, really ugly buildings all day. You know, like anytime you're kind of doodling and dozing off in class, like that is what you see. You see this big factory. I think I combined all of those things to come up with this plot. Many people ask me if that plot line is made up. And I'm like, no. This is based off of like a real case that happened in the Inland Empire. And in fact, that city council then built 3 additional warehouses. Like that school is just sandwiched all around by warehouse facilities. So it's a dangerous issue for a number of reasons. Apart from the air quality, it's like pedestrians and traffic and having these really dangerous trucks around really vulnerable populations like children. And also because I think it gives a really subliminal message to children about what their future looks like. A lot of the problems in the IE are that a lot of students are like pipelined and streamlined to work directly at warehouses, delivering shipments, fulfilling shipments. And this like school to warehouse pipeline is really, really strong there.
Wow. And I used to live in Southern California. So, and I knew people that worked in factories, but I never really made that connection.
Yeah.
Carolina, I want to mention some data from UCLA's Latino Policy and Politics Institute. And when I read this data, it made me think of your book. And this is on health disparities in Latino neighborhoods in California. Latino neighborhoods see twice as many emergency department visits from asthma than white neighborhoods, signaling strain from environmental and climate exposures such as air pollution and heat, extreme heat. Latino neighborhoods are exposed to 2.7 times more diesel particulate matter, which is like soot particles made up of carbon, ash, sulfates, et cetera. And this comes from diesel engines, which power vehicles, as well as heavy equipment and machinery used in industries like manufacturing and construction. And this can increase, or this exposure increases risk of asthma, lung cancer, and heart disease. Again, these are some of the themes in your book. And Latino neighborhoods face 3 times more exposure to hazardous driving, risk of cancer, low birth weight, and chronic disease. Yeah, when we look at a lot of communities of color, Black and brown, there's a whole history of environmental injustice and people being directed or forced or placed in areas where they're exposed to so much toxins and pollutions. This story takes place in the fictional town San Fermín. Mm-hmm. What inspired the name of the town?
That's so funny. There's a big story behind the name. To speak to the point of data, I want to like ground that locally for folks, because I think a really clear example is the way the freeways are situated in the Bay Area. I live close to the 580, and I'm able to take the 580 to work to San Leandro every day. And there are many placards on the way that talk about how I'm driving on a scenic route. And it's beautiful. It's like it goes through mills, it passes the Oakland Zoo. But when you think about where the 880 is located, right, those residents, it's closer to Fruitvale, are constantly breathing in all of the fumes from the semi-trucks that are allowed to drive on 880 and right. not on 580. Similar to the folks who live in Stockton, right, who are dealing with a lot of pollution. So it's very crazy, and that data makes a lot of sense. The town of San Fermin did not have a name until like the 12th hour of me writing this book. Unlike my first book, it is a made-up place. You know, I could not go outside and take a walk and remind myself what the texture and smell and all of that is like living in Oakland. I was not close to the IE. I could not travel to the IE, nor did I want to in some ways. I wanted to be home to write. So I originally was going to base the town off of a real place. I was going to pick one city in the Inland Empire, but I wanted to give myself some artistic freedom to combine details from different communities and different places. So I created a name. The name San Fermin is the name of the patron saint of the bulls. Bulls became a really big theme in the book, through the book, just one by way of like Mexican rodeo culture. There's something called, there's a jaripeo in the book, right? Which is like a Mexican rodeo show. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to nod to that. But a massive theme that became very prevalent in the book was that my protagonist, Paloma, was very bullheaded. She was very stubborn. She was very obstinate. She was defiant. She did not want to change her mind about anything. And so I wanted to honor that in a way that was really subtle. And then like my teacher side came in where I was like, well, a lot of towns in California are San Leandro, San Francisco, San Luis Obispo, by way of the California mission system. So I knew that was at least authentic. So if I really wanted to make it super authentic, that would have been a coastal town. But I was like, now I'm getting too in the weeds. But that was where it all kind of came from, like some California history and then like an homage to some themes in the book and rodeo culture.
Yeah. And I love, too, that you had like Mexican rodeo cowboy culture in the book, because when we think of cowboys, well, some of us or many of us, when we think right. of cowboys, we don't think of Mexicans. We don't think of people of color. And also, too, we don't think of, Mexicans in California. Right. And I grew up near the Fruitvale. So I used to see Mexican men in cowboy hats and like, yeah, all the time. And like the belts with the bulls on them. So I used to see that all the time growing up. That's how I learned. I was like, oh, I didn't know like there was like cowboy culture and Mexican culture and that they influenced cowboy culture. So I was happy to see that. But I want to talk about the narrator of the book, the Shiro Paloma.
Oh, yeah.
She's a high school senior and a student journalist. So I'm biased because she was a student journalist. So, you know, I love that.
Oh, yeah. Journalist.
And she's dealing with so much family stuff, her parents, marriage is strained, and then just the pollution from the air. I was so heartbroken within a scene where her nose is bleeding because the pollution is so bad. She wakes up with nosebleeds. Sometimes she can't go to school, her and her friends, because the air quality is so bad. And but I was thinking just about how so many kids of color, poor kids, can't be kids. You know, she can't just worry about going to college. She has to fight. But she's a great character, and she has a lot of spirit. Tell us about her.
Yeah, I think Paloma is dealing with quite a lot of stress, right? Like her, like you said, her parents' marriage is completely dissipating by way of these warehouses, right? Her dad is a strike leader. Her mom is like, we need money. You can't be on strike. We have to make some money.
Right.
I think what inspired me most about her is, you know, I thought about the protagonist for this book. I knew we were going to have a big conflict, meaning not just family strife, meaning something that was pressing in the world, like environmental injustice, climate change, pollution. So I wanted a protagonist that was observant. So I would describe Paloma as someone who's, as a journalist, like very observant and absorbing the world around her, but still a bit righteous. And I think there's something admirable about that. She grows quite a lot by the end of the book. I think she's a character that I really had to create to be a bit immature at the beginning to have this larger hero arc at the end. But I wanted mainly young Latina, I mean, I write with young Latina women in mind, for them to understand their place in pushing up against issues of injustice. I just wrote this piece for Book Riot where they asked me about young adult books that feature activism.
Yeah, I saw that.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And as I was writing it, I was like, man, like young people really have led movements for activism for a lot of history.
Mm-hmm.
My students and I just discuss the civil rights movement. And when we do, I give them a very realistic run of it, right? So we don't start with the Martin Luther King and blah, blah, blah. I'm like, we got to go back to the beginning. And what I tell them all the time is I was like, it was the murder and lynching of Emmett Till that got people really riled up, right? And like to have a young person be murdered, to see what young people are able to create and spark in communities, it was really powerful. So I wanted her to be a catalyst of change in her own community in that way.
If you're just tuning in, I'm chatting with author Carolina Ixta. Her novel, Few Blue Skies, is about a Mexican-American teenage girl who is trying to protect her family and community from a corporation that's opening warehouses in her town, and the warehouses are causing pollution that's making residents sick. And Carolina's novel is out now, and I've just really been moved and enjoyed reading it, but moved, there's so much emotion. And of course, a Carolina Ixta novel. It's going to come with some romance. And there's such a nice balance of, you know, this heavy topic of environmental justice and injustice. And then also to this sweet young romance between these two teenagers. And Paloma's love interest and co-activist is Julio. And he's grieving the loss of his father, who passed away related to complications from being exposed to toxins when he was working in the warehouse, one of the warehouses in their community. And Julio is mature for his age in many aspects, has to grow up. The death of a parent makes you grow up. He's a good-hearted kid, and he and Paloma love their community and their people. I was joking with you before the interview. I was like, do Julio got an uncle? Javier?
No.
In his 40s. But he's a great kid. So tell us about Julio.
Julio is a great kid. I've made many, many characters, and Julio is one of my favorites, just because he's really sweet kind of all around. He's been dealt a bad hand, you know, I had an uncle pass away a couple of months ago from cancer.
Sorry.
And his son is about my age, a little bit younger. And I had already written the book. The book was on the way to come out, but I was like, oh God, you know. My cousin told me his dad knew he was going to pass away. He was really, really ill. And a couple of days before he passed, they had this really long conversation where he was like, all right, you better be the man of the house. You're the oldest. You have a younger sister. You have to take care of your mom. And I was like, man, that is so heartbreaking. And unfortunately, that's so common, right? With young men, and particularly in a Latino or Mexican household, like there must be a patriarch, good or bad, right? So I was thinking quite a lot about that. But Julio is, yes, dealing with the death of his father and wants very simple things. He's like, you know, I just want to go to UC Davis. I want to study plants. I want to come back and I'm going to make a garden because my dad loved to garden and my dad died of lung cancer. And this is my way of at least paying it forward. That's a saying. So I thought about Julio and I was like, man, I've met many high school boys at this point. Mm-hmm. I wish, you know, there was someone so level-headed when I was in high school. So I think his desires are really also rooted in change. But he's shouldering quite a lot of weight. So is Paloma. But I think when you lose a parent, that's a really, really hard thing to kind of be. So he's very desperate to be able to make this change in his community. He obviously wants to go to UC Davis, which I felt very grateful to learn that UC Davis really is like the number one school for agriculture and botany. So it was cool to be able to pull something somewhat local back into the book.
Yeah.
I was in Davis recently and that also felt really, really special. But yeah, I think Julio's just a really sweet kid, wants really simple things, but his life is really complicated, you know, dealing with the death of a parent, and kind of facing the responsibilities that come with that, not just the practicality of like who's making dinner, who's buying groceries, but the internal aspects of like, I'm grieving, I'm angry, I'm sad all at once, right? There's a lot of blame that also he has to kind of face with his sister that comes up a bit, his sister who's a medical assistant. Julio was also honestly really heavily inspired in ways by my friend Alberto, who's from the IE and who has a sister who's a medical assistant. And I called him and I called his sister quite often when I was drafting the book just to get some details. And I asked him, you know, what it was like to grow up with a sister who worked at a hospital. I was able to talk to her and ask her what that was like. So a lot of that was also rooted in like a real relationship that I have with my friend.
you know, and you mentioned Julio and growth and loss. And so definitely, you know, again, grief is a major theme in the book. And going back to Paloma's and Julio's relationship, I love the stillness within their relationship. Like they gaze at plants in the sky, you know, they're comfortable being silent with each other. Well, you know, not when they're having turbulence in the relationship,
but
when they're good, they're comfortable with being silent with each other, which is not a common image of teenage love. And something I noticed, and my producer did as well, they'll look at different objects or different things, and they'll ask each other, and it's almost a game, and they're like, what color would that
be? Oh, right.
Like, they may look at a puddle or something, and they're like, what color would that be? And they think of names for the colors. And sometimes in Paloma's house, they'll say, oh, you know, what color is the wall? What color should we call the wall? And we want to know, what's the significance of them creating names for colors?
Well, their dads were painters, right? And my grandfather was a painter. And I don't mean an artistic, like, here, and now I'm going to paint this still life, like painted houses. My grandfather painted a lot. He was a carpenter. So I was thinking a lot about that. And I remember just as a kid thinking it was so fun looking at the paint samples. And I knew blue was going to be the color for the book. We were talking about blue, gray as well, right? We were talking about pollution. And I knew I wanted colors to be a really, I would say a motif. I wanted the colors to be a motif through the book because I knew perhaps it's like waxing poetic, but I was thinking about my time in the IE. When I would look at the sky, it really does look like there's a haze just kind of hanging on there. But I thought it was a cute, sweet game. I think when you're in a relationship with someone, you find little, like your little shtick or like your little niches of your relationship. And I thought that would be a fun one for both of them since both of their dads were painters and both of their dads were best friends. And speaking to like their quietness, I think when you're friends with someone from childhood, there is like this beautiful way that you can just be. Like I have friends who I've had since I was in middle school. And we're not constantly talking, right? We're able to be silent and still understand and hold that gravity with one another, which I really, really appreciate. And I think the best relationships are like that, where you're not always on, right? You can just kind of be, and that's the best.
And so I know I was saying Paloma. That was more the English way of saying Paloma. So I'm switching it to say Paloma. So I'm more Spanish.
No, it's Paloma. Paloma's fine.
Okay, Paloma. Okay. I was saying Paloma. Paloma. Okay. All right. So Paloma's family are having some issues. Like we mentioned earlier, dad is on strike because he works for the warehouses. The company's called Selva. So he's an employee of Selva. He's advocating for and negotiating for better working conditions. Paloma's mom is like, I'm tired. I'm the only one making money in the family. I'm exhausted. And I'm working overtime, and it's looking like she might leave and walk out on the family. And so then there's some tension between, or just some distance, like Paloma and her mom just can't really connect and talk. And I'm thinking of gender roles right now, because I know growing up, like I said, I grew up around a lot of Mexican men, and they believe they have a serious work ethic. And so for the woman to be taking care of the household, and that came up in the book too, and I'm thinking like they're in this situation where they're trying to make a decision like, you know, do we sacrifice the family? Do we sacrifice, you know, the community? And he also too, he's the father wants to get better working conditions, you know, in honor of his friend who died, who's Julio's father. Let's talk about how they have to make some tough decisions.
Yeah, that was a tough arc to write. Particularly because I understood both sides. Like, I get the dad going, my best friend died doing this work. They're abusing us. I'm going to go on strike. And I see the story a lot. Like, I watched this documentary called The Delano Manogs about Lariat Leong and the organizing that happened with the United Farm Workers and the Filipino workers who also, like, really spearheaded that movement before the Mexican laborers came in. And I watch it, and it's dominated by men. I mean, of course, there's room for, like, Dolores Huerta. She has a moment, but I frequently always think when there is a man who is, you know, high and mighty and righteous, and for good reason, like, let me make that clear. But when they're a parent, I know there's a woman holding down the fort back at home, right? And I wanted to show a, like, very 360 robust understanding of the consequence of striking. I think strikes are very, very, very important. Like, I wanted that to be very clear in the book. But I think we frequently, it's a very flat depiction. You're striking or you're not. You cross the picket line or you don't. But actually, there's quite a lot of texture and context that happens to a person choosing to go on strike, particularly at home. That means that you are without pay. That means you're likely working longer hours organizing without pay. And I wanted Paloma's mom to be a representative of gender roles, of invisible labor, of like, not only am I working to bring money in, but I cook, I clean, I go to the grocery store, I handle this, I handle that. Because that is what women are often taught to do. And I think Paloma is so teenager in that aspect of not understanding, like, what do you mean, mom? Dad is out here trying to make things work, trying to be your hero. But to me, it's like, dad is being a hero, but also mom is being a hero, right? Being a hero is also who's putting food on the table and who's keeping the lights on. And that's something that it took me a really long time to understand, you know, coming into my own adulthood. But yeah, I wrote that with that in mind of like, well, what is more heroic? I think the book begs the question of who's right and who's wrong in many aspects, right? Particularly because I'm writing to a generation that's really righteous. And I think they're right to be. But frequently we think of issues of justice very in like a pendulous way. I'm right, you're wrong, when there's a lot of room in the middle for both. And I think Paloma's parents are a really good example of dad is right. Dad wants something good, but mom is right. Mom is just trying to get through the day and get food on the table and not be taken advantage of by her husband. So that was where I think the parents really fit into the puzzle.
Carolina, it's really a great book.
Oh, thank you.
It's your second book, and I think it's really well written. I think it's a great book, too, for parents or, you know, grandparents or guardians listening, that this is a book maybe you can read with your teenager in your life, your young adult in your life, and talk about some of the issues that come up. So,
yeah.
So, Carolina, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
That was Oakland author Carolina Ixta. Her YA novel, Few Blue Skies, is in bookstores now. And that's all the time we have for the Sights and Sounds show with Janae Darden. Thank you to our show producer, Porfirio Rangel, our board operator, Damian Miner, and engineer, Gandhi Joe Johnson. And thank you for tuning in. Hey, this Sunday, March 22nd, I'll be performing Spoken Word at the event Celebrating Literary Foremothers, a benefit for Chapter 510. Chapter 510 is a writing center in downtown Oakland for youth, and the benefit's incredible lineup features Berkeley poet laureate Aya De Leon, author Angela Dalton, and poet Judy Juanita, and public historian and celebrated librarian Dorothy Lazard will host. Admission is free, but this is a fundraiser too. And we'll have a link on the Sights and Sounds page for you to RSVP. And next week is our 1 year anniversary episode. Woo! So please tune in next Wednesday at 4 p.m. for another great show. We'll have some prizes and some fun memories to share. Yeah, and some good stuff. So until then, be good to yourselves and each other.